musically, it reminds me quite a lot of the Beach Boys, not in terms of the similarity of the sound, but the fearlessness to kind of completely change the sound of a track numerous times within a 3 minute, 4 minute pop song.
But at the same time, this is also an album about the Iraq War. It's inspired supposedly by Damon's post-apocalyptic train journey through rural China. It's quite a violent album, and I think it's interesting that those two things are sat alongside each other.
And then build an album around this idea, and then get people like Snoop Dogg, like Lou Reed, like Marquee Smith, like Kano, to come up with lyrics and ideas and songs.
Hello and welcome to the first ever episode of Death with a Record. Now, for this inaugural episode, if you haven't seen already on social media, the album we're going to be taking on is Demon Days by Gorillaz. Now, many of you, if not most of you, will have heard of Gorillaz and be aware of them, if not from, you know, one of their multiple chart hits over the noughties, just because they were really the first virtual band that had any success in the UK and on a global scale. Now, just to briefly go over who they are before we get into the main bulk of the episode, Gorillaz are, of course, composed of Damon Albarn, who's responsible for all the music, and then Jamie Hewlett, who's the illustrator, who comes up with the cartoons, does the music videos, and develops the storylines. Now, me and you, Ollie, we were both, I think, both 9 years old at the time of this album's release?
Yeah, 9 or 10, I can't remember.
The year in music, as we obviously usually start off with, the only memory I really have is vaguely of listening to Wake Me Up When September Ends around
Green
that time.
Day. Yeah, everybody had that.
What
CD,
an album.
Lad.
Mate, I think it was my first CD, but anyway, yeah, what else have we got from 2005?
Well, yeah, as a way to gauge that year, I was wondering if you might be able to guess some of the nominees for the Mercury Prize that were released that year, and there is a reason for this.
I see, I'm so bad at this because I don't care about the Mercury Prize at the best of times. So when I was 9 years old, I really had no interest. And I'm pretty sure I know one. Silent Alarm by Block Party, that was around that
good
time.
Good shout, yeah, that's one of them.
From now, I'm not going to necessarily be able to name albums, but I can name some artists.
Yeah,
Franz Ferdinand, maybe?
You're close, because I think they won it a couple of years before 2005, but they did have an album out that year. So that's not a bad shout.
Keane? Whatever that one with Somewhere in a Union.
Kind of similar. Again, it was, I think that was 2004. But yeah, no, you did. You're not too bad.
Coldplay, X and Y?
X and Y, yeah.
Was it on there?
Yeah, that was on there.
Love a bit of that.
Were you ever a fan of Hard-Fi, Stars of CCTV?
Oh, did that get nominated?
That was nominated, mate.
That is a terrible album.
Can you believe that? So was Employment by Kaiser Chiefs.
I was going to say maybe Kaiser Chiefs. Well, they're both not good albums.
The Editors, you could chuck that in there as well.
God, this is proper indie landfill stuff, isn't it?
KT Tunstall.
Oh wow.
MIA brought out a ruler, to be fair, which was pretty cool.
Oh, okay. And then, who won that year?
2005. It was Anthony Johnston, like I Am the Bird. It was one of them where nobody had heard of it and nobody's heard of it since.
I mean, I swear that's quite often with the Mercury
Prize.
Yeah,
yeah. They just try and pick something edgy. I mean, there is one good album, Cole's Corner, Richard Hawley, which I'm going to stand by, even though I know you're going to slate me for it.
No, I like that album, but your obsession with Rich Hawley is kind of definitely based off some kind of like northern moral like framework, which I don't fully understand.
He's a songbird, mate. anyway, yeah, the reason I ask is Gorillaz famously pulled their 2001 debut out of the Mercury Prize shortlist, and it was actually via a clip from the band's virtual bass player and de facto leader Murdoch Nichols, who basically said, "Mercury Award sounds a bit heavy, man. You know, sort of like carrying a dead albatross around your neck for eternity. No thanks, man. Why don't you nominate some other poor muppet?" So yeah, understandably, Demon Days was not considered for 2005's award, which was maybe an early sign that as a group, Gorillaz have never really been bothered about rejecting formulaic processes or institutions. Or my theory is Damon Albarn never really got over being nominated however many times with Blur and never winning it.
Can I just interject here? It is 100% the latter. Like this idea that Gorillaz aren't bothered about, or they're, you know, they don't care about these, you know, old-fashioned institutions. Rubbish. Like Damon is obsessed with presenting Gorillaz as something that, you know, he's just getting away from the limelight. He would love to win the award. It's like, you know, when you kind of like tank a game of tennis because you know you're going to lose anyway, and it's like, oh, I didn't even try. That's exactly what he's doing.
Because he was nominated again in 2014, so it's kind of like, well, if you were that bothered about it, why wouldn't you pull out
pull
again.
It then as well.
But yeah.
Yeah. Rubbish.
Have you got a Rakim bar for 2005, Jamie?
I do. I've not really been feeling myself with these recently, but I decided to specifically refer to one kind of concept or maybe one album from 2005. So if you thought I wasn't going to take any shots at Oasis over the course of this podcast, Ollie, then you do not know me very well. I hate Oasis. I despise the Gallaghers. And I wanted to kind of highlight and accentuate how much I think albums on another level. So I went with a bar from the song No Competition. The bar's pretty simple. It's competition is none. I remain at the top like the sun, and I burn whoever come in the chambers of torture. I caught you. So very simple. Fuck Oasis. It's misogynistic football casual lad rock. And yeah, that's all I have to say on the matter.
Well, I think I might stand a decent chance this week. I've gone for Waiting for the World to End, which was actually produced by DJ Premier and is actually not a bad song, because there aren't many good ones in Rakim's solo career. So yeah, it's actually worth checking
there's
out.
There's a couple.
Yeah, there's a few. And the bar is, I see destruction, even little kids trust none. They bust guns, that's what they get a rush from. This hints at some of the topics we're going to be covering in today's podcast, because obviously violence, guns and children are all very prominent themes on Demon Days. So yeah, I'm going to say I won that.
Oh, mate, you 100% took that. Yeah, I just wanted to get a shot at Liam Gallagher. Like, let us know, people who are listening, but I'm safe to say you took that one.
Nice. Well, anyway, yeah, that was the era of music.
Let's get on to the album. Ollie, I wanted to do something a bit different as well this week. If we can start off this album talk, and I want you to imagine I'm the guy from the Headspace app, you know, the kind of meditation app, the one that has that really obnoxious... Yeah, the really obnoxious voice. So if we can just kind of fade up the ambient music in the background in post-production.
Ooh.
Right. Are you ready, Ollie?
Yes.
Lay back on the couch. Make yourself comfortable. Imagine yourself by the side of a busy road. The passing cars representing the passing thoughts and feelings. Don't be unsettled by the movement of the traffic. Change your relationship with the passing thoughts and feelings. Be ready to think openly about your life. Let the memories open up into each other, like they're sitting here with you right now. You should now be ready to answer my questions, Big Ol. The first question is this. What does this record, Demon Days by Gorillaz, remind you of most?
I remember hearing a lot of it on the radio when I was growing up, so maybe driving to school with my brother and my granny, or my brother and my mum, because I remember Josh used to play it quite a lot, so that's probably my defining childhood memory, I guess.
Well, I'm gonna stop you there, Ollie, because it's funny that you say that. I happened to speak to your brother, Josh, about this album and some of the moments you might be recounting there. And I want to see if Josh's memory of this album and his relationship with you is any different to what you've just relayed to me there. So let's roll that clip now.
Back when I was a little ute in the glory days of year four, I went round to my mate's house. We were in the CD. We were tired of playing on the computer, so we just thought, you know, I'll stick it on. About 10 o'clock at night. And before I knew it, it was 4 a.m. in the morning, and we just listened to this album non-stop. We'd listen through it, go back to the beginning, and listen to it all over again. And that was probably one of the most significant nights I've had in terms of listening to music, without question. I remember going back, begging with mum, and pleading with Ol to just buy it on iTunes, for God's sake. You know, I couldn't have met tougher competition. So I had to wait till Christmas. And I remember the excitement I got when I unwrapped it Christmas morning and saw what I'd got in my hands. And to be honest, I think a tear welled down my eye at that point. But I remember sticking it on quite frequently because I just thought it was a masterpiece in its entirety. But Ol just couldn't think of it in lower terms at that point. He thought the name of the band was ridiculous. He thought the fact that they used cartoon characters was ridiculous. He thought all the tracks on the album, bar Feel Good Inc., were ridiculous. And the reason I know he liked Feel Good Inc. is because he made a bloody compilation CD and put that song on it, despite trying to tell me that the album was shite. What's he doing there? But his criticism of it couldn't have been, well, more severe, really. Anytime I'd try and stick it on or stick a track on from that album, Oliver would always basically tear that right away from me. He's talking about doing a podcast about it. I just find it ironic, let's say.
Well, 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 this is a scandalous revelation, and I suppose you have to have the right of
a right of reply.
Yeah, right of reply. Do you have anything to say for yourself?
Do you know what? I can't really defend. I can't defend anything he said. One thing I will say is the only reason I put it on the compilation CD was because I knew that he liked that song, so I thought, you know, I'll give
him. It was an olive branch.
That was an olive branch. Wow. And I think it was more, I just resented the fact that he had any selections on in the car, and therefore I was going to just be a horrible older brother and just, you know, not bully him, but just try and quieten him down. So do you know what? I have to take my medicine with that one. That was my bad. So yeah, sorry, Josh.
Well, there's some wounds there you have to heal. Can you quickly tell me what else was on that mixtape besides Feel Good Inc?
Do you know what? I definitely remember Lose Yourself by Eminem being on there. Now that you've mentioned Green Day, I feel like there must have been a Green Day track on there.
And that would work out time-wise.
Have you ever heard Are You Ready for Love by Elton John?
Yeah, of course.
That was on there as well for some reason, yeah.
Well, we need to get our hands on this.
That would be worth a lot of money on Discogs right now, I'm telling you.
Yeah, definitely. Anyway, the reason I brought that up is that this album is quite a weird album thematically, because it's almost split in half. There's one half of it that is quite child-centred. There's literally a song titled Kids With Guns, there's all the child's choirs that are over this thing, then there are literally members of the virtual band that are 10 years old, and there's all the backstories you can get lost in for children in the cartoons. But at the same time, this is also an album about the Iraq War. It's inspired supposedly by Damon's post-apocalyptic kind of train journey through rural China. It's quite a violent album, and I think it's interesting that those two things are sat alongside each other. So to get back in the vibey headspace, Holly, do you still think of Demon Days as the album that your brother spammed in the car during childhood, or do you see it as this kind of political allegory for the way the world was heading over the next 15 years?
Probably closer with spamming, because it's the one occasion where he's been proved right by the passage of time and never lets me forget about it. And just because he was right about Gorillaz doesn't mean that I'm going to, you know, listen to the multitude of bass line or drill tracks that he's trying to play me.
Yeah, I forgot he's into bass line.
Yeah, but no, in all seriousness, I think the album is definitely one that I feel has more to say to me now than it did when I was busy ignoring Josh. And even when I did come into it later on in life, I was never really picking up on much of the political sentiment. I was always more interested in the music itself rather than what the album was saying about the world around me, whether that was the Iraq War or the environment or whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, if you take, you know, the Booty Brown verse on Dirty Harry, for example, from The Far Side, like obviously his whole verse is an exploration of the mental and physical trauma that being a soldier in a war brings. But I was never really focused on the bulk of that verse. I was always focused on the final two bars, which is, remember when I used to dance, man, all I want to do is dance. And then the beat drops back in. Because to me, that's first and foremost what this record is. It's just a pop album filled with absolute bangers. And I definitely came round to the political side of things much later on. Because I think that's probably quite an innocent and childlike reading of the album.
Mm.
Being more interested in this kind of different mishmash of genres and styles rather than very, you know, specific lyrical or political content. And it's funny, actually, because there's a really good Gorillaz documentary on YouTube. I don't know if you've seen it. It's called Bananas.
Yeah, I've seen it.
Yeah. And it basically, for the listeners, maybe, it just charts the early initial stages of Gorillaz from like 1999 to before they released their debut to like 2005, 2006, when Demon Days had come out.
Mm.
And there's a really, really, probably my favourite scene, actually, is when Gorillaz are playing, they're on a Demon Days tour and they're playing a gig in New York City. And Damon has tried to enlist the help of a kind of local youth choir, basically, to sing with them at a concert, and specifically sing the backing vocals on Dirty Harry. And whoever's printed out the song's words for the choir has made this really bad mistake. So a situation arises where, you know, a choir of young African-American children are singing, "I need a gun to keep myself from harm." And like the choir leader is just obviously appalled. Damon has to try and explain to them this mistake. And they have quite an intense but amicable conversation about whether this type of language is appropriate or just provocative. All the while, you can just hear the kids in the background singing, you know, blissfully unaware of what was going on. I mean, what do you think about the fact that there's children singing on it? Do you think it's necessary? Because surely he could have found another way to get that kind of effect.
Well, firstly, in regards to the documentary, that scene, something that you haven't mentioned, which is because it was, as you say, intense but amicable. There's this one moment where Damon's like obviously quite aware that this choir leader is annoyed and suspicious about the lyrics, and then doesn't he say something like, "Oh, but my mum loves this song. Like, my mum loves it as well." It's like the most David Brent thing.
David Brent is exactly what it is. He's just scrambling around. It's something like, "My mum thinks that these records are provocative, and my mum thinks this." And it's like, what are you on about?
Why are you talking about your mum? In regards to the question about intention, like, I think there is clear intention behind it. I'd also say, like, it's not a new thing, is it? It's like the oldest trick in the book to have, like, a kids' choir sing something that is in fact a bit sinister, or like it concerns like an uncomfortable truth. So in this case, we've got children like inflicting violence against each other. If you look at like Another Brick in the Wall, has a children's choir on it. Paper Planes by MIA has it. That's a Hard Knock Life by Jay-Z. Loads of early Kanye stuff has a child's choir singing on it. And I think it's like a good way of having a bringing these two things into conflict with each other, like the innocence of children singing like lyrics that aren't innocent. So I think it's a fair point. The other thing I would say is that Jamie Hewlett and Damon Albarn have both been quite clear about how they thought that Gorillaz, or one of the coolest things about Gorillaz to them, was that they would put these references in the music and in the visuals about pieces of culture they were inspired by. And then they wanted the children who were listening to it, it's kind of our age and up to, let's say, 15, 16, to kind of look up what those references were and then become, you know, and then become obsessed with them too. So, you know, one day there'd be a next generation of artists and writers who could say, "Oh, back in the day, I listened to Gorillaz when I was 12, and it was the first time I ever got, you know, put onto this or that."
Did you have an experience? Because obviously, I kind of missed that step. Did you have an experience like that, listening to Demon Days?
I mean, I was thinking about this the other day. I can't remember a time before Feel Good Inc. where I heard rapping on a song that I loved. Like, I'm sure I would have heard it peripherally, but like in forms of a track that I was listening to non-stop, which I was, and watching the video of, that was the first time I was really introduced to hip-hop or rapping, and through De La Soul, which is obviously like such a amazing way to be introduced. So 100%. And I'm not sure about you, Yoli, but like in forms of the dub and like the reggae elements on Demon Days, it wasn't like I was listening to Scientist in South Wales in the early 2000s, so it was definitely the first time I heard that as well. I mean, so you missed out on that, you're saying, with the kind of the Josh issue that we've chatted earlier.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I got into rap, this is a bit vague, but kind of through Eminem as a child, just because he was just completely ubiquitous.
Yeah.
But then, as I've become older, I've started to appreciate, you know, like De La Soul, MF Doom, Roots Maneuver, way more on this record than I did when it was released. I mean, speaking about, you've mentioned Feel Good Inc. there. Should we chat about some of the music, some of the songs?
Yeah, let's do it. I mean, Feel Good Inc. especially, it highlights how this album is just full of absolutely banging pop songs, as you were saying earlier, like massive hits as well. I mean, do you think there was a better single released in the noughties between 2000 and 2010 than Feel Good Inc.? Because I would argue that there isn't.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you're trying to not summarise the decade, but thinking about what were the defining tunes of that decade, I think you've got like Smile by Lily Allen, maybe.
Wow, interesting.
Gnarls Barkley, Crazy, which was just, that, I mean, 100%. That was at number one for just like a stupid amount of time.
And another Danger Mouse production.
Obviously, you got James Blunt, Beautiful, which I'm sure you were a massive fan of back in the
day. Would you put that in?
Definitely not. But I find it funny because Field Inc. is obviously amazing, but I can't believe it didn't go to number one. I don't know if you were aware of that.
I mean, I wasn't.
So can you guess which song went to number one and stayed there for 7 weeks at the same time that Field Inc. was released?
So it wasn't James Blunt, I hope.
It wasn't James Blunt.
Can you just tell me, put me out of my misery? I'm going to hate this.
You're really going to hate this. Is This the Way to Amarillo by Tony Christie and Peter
Kay? What? Is this the way to Amarillo? serious?
I'm deadly serious. Wow, it was there for seven weeks. 7 weeks at number one.
Are you kidding me?
How bad is that?
What the fuck, man?
I mean, you know, big up raising money for Comic Relief and whatnot, but oh my days. Really, really bad.
God, I just want to move.
Yeah, we should probably just stop the podcast there, to be honest. But yeah.
Oh my days. Yeah, I mean, it's Feel Good Inc. We were talking about Feel Good Inc. The best song of the... So this is the thing, another kind of debate to be had here. Like, you know, you were talking about it encapsulating the decade, which I think is a lot more relevant to the question of what is the best song of a decade than it is saying, like, you know, what your favourite song is or what you think the most musically ambitious song is. Because there'll be some people that'll come in and be like, well, actually, guys, I think the best song of the noughties is probably Weird Fishes by Radiohead. It's like, well, you're fucking missing the point. Because...
Sounds like something you might say, mate.
Well, yeah. Wow, okay, mate. Okay. You're going to go defend Comic Relief again? Is that what it's all about? But yeah, like I think the question is more, as you were saying, what encapsulates the decade? And I think Feel Good Inc. does that more than any other song I can think of. Hmm.
One thing that I feel about that song is there's a few moments on Demon Days where... Damon tries to use kind of acoustic bridges or little interludes from within tracks.
It's kind of the Damon trope, isn't it?
Yeah, a little bit. Like, okay, we'll have this really cool electronic sound, but then I'll intersperse it with snippets of me, you know, singing somberly and playing an acoustic guitar. Yeah. Sometimes, you know, it feels a bit annoying. But then I think on Feel Good Inc., where, you know, I think the hook is like windmill, windmill, for the land, turn forever, hand in hand. I think that's one occasion where it just works perfectly with the lyrics and the message of the song. You know, it's evoking this land of like milk and honey away from mega corporations or this, you know, Feel Good Inc. polluting and destroying the planet. Mm. And I don't know about you, but musically, it reminds me quite a lot of the Beach Boys, not in terms of the similarity of the sound, but the fearlessness to kind of completely change the sound of a track numerous times within a 3 minute, 4 minute pop song. So I feel like Brian Wilson did that. Like if you think about Good Vibrations, for example, like there's a whole like 30 seconds where it just goes completely differently and then cuts back in.
Yeah, that's a good point actually. And I think the other thing as well, like to do that and it be a really successful pop song, albeit one that only reached number two in the charts, is the most impressive thing, because there's all manner of experimental music that does that, but none of it really manages to maintain or retain the sense of it being a pop song.
Yeah, absolutely.
Anyway, as well as big singles, there were some massive collaborations on this album. One of the most memorable, for me at least, is Sean Ryder's appearance on Dare.
It's Dare.
Full disclosure, we are massive Sean Ryder fans on this podcast.
Sure. Like,
not even necessarily just the Happy Mondays music, but just him as a guy. He's brought us so much joy over the years. And speaking of number ones, this is Sean Ryder's only ever number one single in the UK, which is a bit sad.
Is it Gorilla's only number one as well?
It might be. I'm presuming. I thought Melancholy Hill may have got number one. I haven't looked this up, so people will have to tell me.
It must have been their first, wasn't it? So maybe they've had one since.
No, did Clint Eastwood not get number one?
I'm not going to. People should let us know. We probably should have done this research, shouldn't we?
Yeah, we should have. People can let us know. But anyway, there's a great story from the recording of Dare, which Sean Ryder tells, which needs to be said if you want to take that away.
So I think, I don't know, I don't want to speak for you, but when I first heard that song, I didn't know who Sean Ryder was. I remember seeing it and hearing it on the radio, and I just thought, what the heck is he talking about? This doesn't make any sense. And basically, we found... at least Sean's interpretation of how that song was recorded. And yeah, this is a direct quote. So I put the headphones on and there was no track. I started saying to them to turn it up and the track was very slowly turning up. So I started going, it's coming up, it's coming up, it's coming up. And when he got as loud as I wanted, I said, it's Dare. As in like text speech, I will see you dare. I then tried to freestyle something, a right load of gibberish bollocks. It was, and it ended in, I never did no harm. Then I took the cans off after 10 minutes, and Damon said, do that coming up bit again, but a bit faster. So I did it, and that was it.
God bless your rider, man.
Big up, Sean Ryder.
I'm sure at least some people remember on GTA San Andreas that Sean Ryder did the voice acting for a character in that game called Macca as well. And what it meant was that obviously there was parts of him in the storyline too, but when you were just kind of driving around the the city of San Andreas, if you like hit into like pedestrians, some of them would have the voice of Sean Ryder. So like you'd be kind of driving along, and if you ran someone over, one of them would be like, "Oh fucking hell! Like get the fuck out the way and shit like this." But if you go on YouTube, there's actually a soundboard of like all of the quotes that you'll hear from Sean Ryder acting in Grand Theft Auto. And I'll play a couple of them for you guys now, so you know what I mean.
It's on fire! Fucking hell! Fucking hell, his car's on fire! Now I'm really tripping! We're upside down! I should've got a fucking taxi instead, man! You can't drive for shit, our Carl! Carl, you drive like a fucking wanker! Fucking hell, Archie!
Cool, well, the reason I bring this up, Al, is I think you will also remember this story.
Yeah.
But there was a couple of years ago, well, 3 or 4 years ago now, which is shocking, when we were in America, we were at a house party in Chapel Hill, and I think we were both quite energized by each other's presence. So we were feeling like we were big dogs, like, oh, English Brits abroad, like, you know, let's go. It's quite a busy house party, and it was one where the aux cable was passing around as it always does, and we had control of it at this moment. I think we'd put on Blue Monday, and it had gone down pretty well. Everyone was like, you know, everyone was liking it, and we were thinking, you know, we are the dog's bollocks, like whacking on New Order in America.
We're college,
look at us.
Man.
In college, exactly. And then I don't know what possessed us to do this. I think because maybe we were too gassed up. But we took the YouTube clip of Sean Ryder speaking in GTA and then put it on the aux after Blue Monday. So there's this packed party of everyone dancing to Blue Monday, then it stops, and then all you start hearing is,
"You can't drive for shit, our Carl! Carl, you drive like a fucking wanker! Fucking hell, our kid!"
The whole room just went completely silent, and we were just sat there at the aux thinking that we were being funny, and in reality they were just looking at us like, who are these guys? Like, who do they think they are?
Yeah, with hindsight, that was a low moment for us, I think.
It was a low moment, but at least it might give people some insight into why Sean Ryder means so much to us.
I like to think we broke Sean Ryder in North Carolina as a result of that party.
Yeah, Sean Ryder's popularity, the Happy Mondays have suddenly seen a massive spike of streams in the Rally Chapel Hill Durham area.
All thanks to Death with the Record. But yeah, I think I, just from a purely selfish point of view, I think on socials this week we're going to be doing like a best collection of Sean Ryder's moments, his videos and quotes. So definitely keep your eyes peeled on Instagram for that, because there's some absolute gold dust coming up. To end the album chat, Jamie, have you got a favourite collaboration on Demon Days, or like across Gorilla's discography in general?
I'm not sure about on Demon Days, across the whole discography. Off the top of my head, I really like Lou Reed's feature on Plastic Beach, Some Kind of Nature.
Yeah.
I think considering that he died a couple of years after that, and that's one of the last kind of things that he was doing, I really like that. I'll go with that. Have you got one?
That seems to happen a few times, actually, with artists that collaborate with Gorillaz. Like, Bobby Womack packed it in a few years ago, didn't he?
And so I didn't think about that.
So did the singer from 2000, the...
Buena Vista Social Club.
So yeah, maybe...
Oh, Ibrahim, what's his name? Yeah, did he... Oh, wow.
Gorillaz have this kind of, like, dark touch.
Yeah, well, let's start this conspiracy right now. Like, you collaborate with Peter Hook's about to die. That's all I can say. What about in the future? Have you got anyone you would like to see them collab with?
I think I'd like to see something with Andre 3000, you know. I think that could be quite cool.
Shit. Yeah, that's an amazing shout.
Have you got any ideas for that?
Probably Liam Gallagher, I'd say.
Well, I mean, the funny you say that, but there's actually a 2017 documentary called No Human Idol or something like that, and it's like a video diary of their 2017 tour, and in one of the London gigs, like, Noel Gallagher's on stage singing along, playing the guitar and stuff, and you think, well, you guys have, you know, reconciled your differences since the 90s, eh? Like, it's a bit weird.
They play on Graham Norton together.
Yeah,
I think they play A Song of Humans and Noel Gallagher's there. It's like, what?
It's a bit weird, that.
It is weird. Should we move on to Apex?
Yeah, definitely. Let's pretend for a second that Gorilla's career is kind of laid out before us with all the peaks and troughs and whatnot. What we're trying to talk about in our Apex segment is, where does Demon Days fall? Is this their finest album, or is there another that betters it? Basically, is this record the Mount Everest, or should we be looking down at the bottom of the sea? As a way to frame this week's episode, Jamie, I just want to touch on some of the producers that Gorillaz have worked with over the last 20 years, because I think it's worth noting that over 7 records, they got the debut, you know, Demon Days, Plastic Beach, Humans, few others as well. They've worked with quite a lot of names, the likes of Dan the Automator, Danger Mouse, James Ford, Remy Kabaka Jr., Twilight Tone, Stephen Sedgwick. I mean, like on their new album, Song Machine, which is coming out, I think it was already out actually. There's like 10 producers just on that album alone. And I think that this experimentation with producers, along with Damon's, you know, creativity and all the guests they have on, has meant that you could never claim that Gorillaz have kind of stood still in terms of sound from album to album, because they're quite unsentimental in that regard. I think all of this is just quite a long precursor basically to say that in a parallel universe, Jamie Cameron has become an executive producer at Parlophone Records, which is Gorillaz' label. Nice. And Jamie, you now have the final say over their new album and the direction that it's going to take musically. So what I want to know is, what kind of law are you going to be laying down with Damon Albarn? Are you going to be telling him, you know, don't want any of that Demon Days rubbish, lad. You can forget The Fall as well. I want Humans Part 2 by Monday, or your days here are numbered. What are you going to be saying?
Well, there's one thing that I would make abundantly clear, which is that maximum 12 tracks. I am so done with bloated double albums. And this isn't even necessarily Gorillaz specifically, as much as Humans, that did apply to Humans. There's just so many albums out there these days that can be improved by just getting rid of a few of the tracks. Mm. Like, release a B-sides album if you want, which they did, right? That's what The Fall is, kind of. But don't feel the need to put every song you wrote in a two-year period onto an album. Besides that, honestly, I'd just let Damon do his thing. I'd be like, fucking 12 tracks. Besides that, have your day out.
So brevity is the key for Jamie Cameron, is that right?
Well, not as much brevity. Well, yeah, brevity as well as like a bit more, you know, having the ability to edit yourself.
Quality
or
over
yourself.
Quantity.
Absolutely, mate. Absolutely.
Well, if so, I mean, thinking about that, have you got a favourite Gorillaz album? Do you think Demon Days is their best?
I don't know, man. I think, first of all, this is not like an Apex situation in which you've got Mount Everest and then like Netherlands next to it. I would say that it's like kind of Mount Everest, K2, whatever the third tallest mountain in the world is. I don't know. That there's three albums that are really high up there. For me, they're Plastic Beach, the debut, and then Demon Days. I think all three of them are really, really high up. Personally, right now, I think their Apex is Plastic Beach. I think it's their poppiest, production-wise, like it's their most... kind of glittering and fancy sounding. It's the thing about the first two records is that they can be a bit relentlessly dark, and the production is, if you listen to them non-stop, it's a bit muggy. Is that a fair point?
Yeah, but I think that's what I like about the debut quite a lot. It's really kind of oozy sludge.
Wow, you're really selling it, oozy sludge.
But I know exactly what you mean about Plastic Beach, because for me, the scale and like the opulence on that album is crazy. You know, like you've got all these mad orchestral openings that sound incredibly grand.
Yeah.
But, you know, I just think some of the stuff on their debut, like Tomorrow Comes Today, Man Research, Clapper, whatever it's called.
Yeah.
5-4. I just quite like how it's like really rugged, really kind of psychedelic.
You say their debut is their apex, okay? No, all downhill from that.
I think Demon Days is their best album, but in terms of if I could, you know, get Damon to, you know, carry on a sound from a specific record, I'd really like to see what kind of sequel they could make to their debut at this point with all the kind of connections and collaborations that they have. Because there's not actually that... Mm. I think there's maybe two appearances on the first one. There's the...
The Funky Homo Sapien.
Yeah. Whereas, you know, Plastic Beach and Demon Days and Humans are obviously got absolutely countless number of collaborators.
Yeah.
And then, you know, The Fall and the Now and their debut to some extent have far less. So yeah, I also think it's kind of interesting. There seems to be kind of two different types of Gorillaz albums in terms of like explicit collaborators. That's kind of interesting to me. I quite like the idea that he's in the studio with all these different people, and then on the next album he just by himself because he's getting fucking fed up with having to work with everybody.
Yeah, well, I mean, that, which, and by that logic, right now he is working with everyone, because Song Machine, the whole concept is that every single track is right produced by someone else and collaborating with someone else. And honestly, I really, really like the singles so far. Like, I think they've all been good, and I think this could be, if he can moderate himself, and we'll see what happens in the track listing, this could be, you know, the Gorillaz album that is kind of a real return to form. So, yeah.
So we're saying Demon Days or Plastic Beach or the debut.
Yeah, the three peaks. We'll go with the three peaks.
Scarfell Pike, the one in Wales, and Ben Nevis.
What do you mean, the one in Wales? How dare you? Snowdonia,
that's
mate.
It. My bad.
Mount Snow. Unbelievable. Right, let's move on to alternate cuts. This is the section where we kind of try and engage a bit with the cultural history of the band and how they relate to wider culture, and then throw out one of our alternate cuts about how we kind of perceive the band and how they relate. I wanted to open things, of course, looking at virtual bands, specifically the history of virtual bands as a concept, because everyone goes on about Gorillaz as the virtual band, and Jamie Hewlett himself, you know, he's been asked why he thinks there haven't been ones who are as successful as Gorillaz, and I'm quoting directly what he said here, because nobody would dare copy us. We did it first, and we did it as best as it could be done.
It's not too modest.
Yeah, there's maybe some irony there, I'm not sure. But there is a history that goes back before Gorillaz. So even though the term hadn't been coined at the time, technically Alvin and the Chipmunks were the first virtual band to exist. And they were formed in the late 1950s, obviously with the accelerated recording of voices to create that sound. In the 60s, there was more American fictional bands. The Archies were formed out of the animated TV series The Archie Show. And then more recently, and definitely more relevantly to Gorillaz, there is a deep debt to anime and Japanese idol culture and a lot of virtual bands. So much so that I consulted my friend who is a self-proclaimed weeb, and he described Gorillaz as anime for normies. So he's saying that it's basically ripping off all of that. Some quick examples of that would be the singer Hatsune Miku and then the YouTuber Kasuna Al as well. Anyway, I was thinking about this concept more generally. You know, the buzz that was generated kind of circa 2000 to 2005 about virtual bands and Gorillaz, it reminds me of something else. Do you remember, Ollie, when everyone thought that 3D was the future of cinema? Like, Avatar had just come out, and it's like, oh my god, 3D is amazing. Like,
Avatar,
this is the next
Avatar was the first 3D film I watched in the cinema, actually. I remember getting the glasses and whatnot.
Yeah, and at that point, all the studios and all the audiences were like, right, this is the future. Like, film is, this is where it's going. Can you imagine in 10 years what the technology we're going to have is? And lo and behold, it's died, because it's not really, you know, interesting or revolutionary. It's just a gimmick. And I wonder, once you get past the idea of virtual bands and the novelty and the kind of, wow, how postmodern is this? Is it actually as cool and interesting as you think? So, like, given Gorillaz and all the interesting things going on there, Damon Albarn's songwriting, the collaborations, the melding of genres, is the virtual band aspect just like one of the more relevant things about the band?
I don't know if I see the two sections as completely kind of autonomous and separated. I think, obviously, if all you're interested in is the music, then you're perfectly capable of limiting your interaction with Gorillaz to that. And I'm not going to speak for you, but over the last 10 years, that is largely what I've done. I've just listened to the albums. But what I would say now is that I feel as though having a grasp of the characters, who they are, their storylines, the concepts behind each album has probably increased my enjoyment of the music, and it's definitely increased my enjoyment of the music videos. And maybe to explore this a little bit, it might be best if I briefly explain who the four virtual members of Gorillaz are. So the first is Murdoch Nichols, who is the guy that I was speaking about in the introduction. And despite being the bassist, he's the kind of de facto leader of the band, responsible for bringing people together, harbours a grudge that he's not the front man, generally really nasty piece of work. He's a Satanist, spent time in prison, which during those stretches, the band have to kind of draft in another bass player who's, funnily enough, a villain from... Do you remember the Powerpuff Girls, the cartoon?
I watched it, but I remember it.
So it's a guy called Ace Coppola from there. And for some reason, I don't know whether Jamie Hewlett's friends with the person who made Powerpuff Girls, but yeah, Ace Coppola, this villain from the Powerpuff Girls, ends up coming and playing bass in Gorillaz for a little bit. Then there's the frontman 2D, who's a bit of a simpleton, but sings, plays keyboard. He's kind of seen as Damon's character, even though his speaking voice is narrated by somebody else. Then there's Noodle, who's a Japanese musician who came to the attention of the band after they put an advert out in a paper for a new lead guitarist, and a FedEx crate arrives at their studio over the next day, and this 10-year-old Noodle pops out, and she's like a musical prodigy and supposedly wrote all the music on Demon Days, which I guess is important for this podcast. And then finally is Russell Hobbs, who's like the sole American member of the band. He's responsible for drums and percussion. And basically, as a teenager in New York, his friends that were rappers were all killed in a drive-by shooting, and their spirits now inhabit his body and come out now and again to make guest vocal appearances. All that means is basically that Russell is this kind of like perfect hip-hop musician. And I'm not trying to say that when I'm listening to Demon Days, I'm listening to a drum beat and thinking, oh yeah, this is, you know, the spirit of Russell's friend coming out. But one thing I do think is, take Plastic Beach as an example. I find it fascinating that you can come up with, you know, a cartoon concept of this kind of hazardous sludge in the middle of the ocean, and then build an album around this idea, and then get people like Snoop Dogg, like Lou Reed, like Marquis Smith, like Kano, to come up with lyrics and ideas and songs around that idea.
The revolution will be televised. And the pollution from the ocean, now with devotion. Push peace and keep it in motion.
Conceptually, I find it interesting, even if all the kind of background character stuff that I just spent a good 5 minutes talking about isn't strictly important.
Since I wrote this question a couple of days ago, I've cooled dramatically on the take. Like, I was going back and I watched every music video they've ever released over the past couple of days. And I was looking at all the YouTube comments, and like, it seems that most fans of Gorillaz really engage with the characters and the stories. Like, there's people commenting on the new Aries video with the Peter Hook track off Song Machine, being like, oh, you know, this is expressing Murdoch's jealousy for 2D and all. And it's like, I'm not sure I realise quite the extent to which Gorillaz fans, or at least the fanatical element of their fandom, are really committed to the idea. And I was like, you know what, this is actually quite oddly heartwarming, and I'm in on it.
I'd extend that to even the musicians, man. I watched an interview with Del the Funky Hope and Sapien. So he's the rapper that appears on Clint Eastwood, for people who aren't familiar. And he was basically saying that when he became involved with Gorillaz, obviously on the first album, he didn't really care that much about Damon or Blur. He was like, the reason I got involved with it was because of Jamie Hewlett, and I knew about him because I'm into comics. And, you know, I think obviously Jamie Hewlett takes somewhat of a kind of backseat because Damon Albarn is who he is and Blur are who they are in this country. But I definitely don't think the animation side should be underestimated when we're talking about the cultural impacts of this band, because like, Damon Albarn has had, you know, solo projects with really famous musicians that aren't anywhere near as popular or as kind of culturally, you know,
relevant
as Gorillaz.
That's true. I mean, also, we're at a point where Gorillaz are globally vastly more popular than Blur.
Yeah, which is interesting.
Yeah, it is interesting. I mean, could we say this, that overall the concept of virtual bands in general is maybe a bit trite, but in this instance Gorillaz have done it really well, and they have got, you know, people, really talented musicians, to buy in on the idea.
Yeah,
and because of that it really works.
Yeah, I think that's probably a fair assessment. Speaking about artwork, should we move on to the final section, album cover?
Yeah,
nightclub,
mate. Album cover nightclub, let's get our graft on.
Right, okay. So, I mean, yeah, obviously Death with the Records and music podcast, so it's kind of natural that we've spent more time talking about Gorillaz. But, you know, this is obviously a visual category, so it's a good opportunity to speak about Jamie Hewlett and kind of his story, basically. And I don't know if you know Jamie, but he was, you know, a bit of a name back in the 80s because he was the co-creator of a comic strip called Tank Girl, which was centered around a female character called Tank Girl, who, yep, you guessed it, drove a tank around that she also lived with. But yeah, this plot sounds absolutely crazy. She had like a mutant kangaroo boyfriend called Booger. And yeah, interestingly, there was actually a Tank Girl film made in 95, which originally had Steven Spielberg lined up to direct, if you can believe that. But, but yeah, in the end, he seemed to have dodged a bullet because the film was like a commercial and critical flop, and I think Jamie basically had very little to do with it. But yeah, he was a bit of a big name in the kind of comic art and illustration scene, and he and Damon ended up living in a flat together back in the 90s, where I imagined that they kind of bonded over a disdain for MTV and a bit of a soft spot for heroin. Anyway, this is where the idea for Gorillaz was kind of hatched. Going back to Demon Days, I think this is probably up there as one of the most recognisable covers that that's going to be queuing up for our nightclub in the series. Obviously, starter packs were not a sensation back in 2005 as much as they are now. But the cover's layout is essentially the same. It's just kind of like four square images of the band members, 2D, Murdoch, Noodle and Russell. And to be honest, the cover is a bit of a rip on some other famous albums, maybe most noticeably the Finals Beatles studio album, Let It Be. If you Google that, it looks quite similar. Even the Blur's Greatest Hits compilation is a very similar layout. And it's something that they've returned to on Humans. Funnily enough, the concept behind Humans was kind of one last party before the end of the world. And a lot of the music video and artwork are all set in nightclubs and on dance floors. But obviously, we all know there's only one venue that Gorillaz are bothered about getting into. And that is Death With The Records album cover nightclub.
So as always, I just want to remind our listeners that Jamie and I always end our podcast with the album cover nightclub segment. So this part of the podcast basically imagines a scenario where the album cover is trying to get into a club, but Jamie and I are the bouncers. And, you know, we're not looking for your standard kind of things, the ID that you've got, the tie you're wearing, the dress you might have put on to try and impress us. No, there's only four things that we're bothered about. Originality, harmony between music and artwork, aesthetics, and whether or not you consider the cover to be iconic. Like any nightclub worth its salt, there are four ranks. So first of all is GOAT, highest level Hall of Fame. This is like where Michael Jordan's going to be sitting. Second of all, VIP. So not quite GOAT, but still a very respectable cover.
That's some bottles of Belvedere in that section, things like that.
Definitely. Third, ticket on the door. You're very, very close to being sent home. So you are pretty lucky that Jamie and I are feeling so generous. And last and least, name's knocked down, not getting in.
Aesthetic effort, get out of our sight, etc, etc.
Jamie, what are you thinking?
Right, well, I kind of have an inkling that you're going to try and argue that this is GOAT level. So I'm just going to come in and say, I think it's in on the door. But what happens is they get in on the door, find a ticket, they're in the nightclub, they start hanging around the VIP area, this album cover does, so they end up in VIP. Does that make sense, or is that a bit convoluted?
That does make sense.
So it's like on the borderline between the two. I think, obviously, it's iconic, and as you say, it's very recognisable, but it is essentially a rip-off of like dozens of albums before that have a similar look. And I actually prefer the Humans cover because I think just the aesthetic's a bit more modern. But what do you think? Are you going to try and argue for GOAT or what?
I think with the exception of the Now, I think the group have pretty consistent album covers. I really like the debut. Demon Days, I think, is cool, and Plastic Beach is pretty cool as well. And I think actually, if we were kind of questioning this, you know, it would be a pretty bad reflection on Jamie Hewlett's contribution to the band in general.
It's probably got to be VIP, isn't it? I mean, the band literally has a person who draws for the band with them. If they can't make a good album cover, then
I would go VIP.
Do you think it's close to getting GOAT level, or is it just
no?
VIP?
I think just VIP.
Yeah, go on then. VIP. We let him in VIP.
Nice one.
Get the Belvedere. Well, I mean, I guess that brings us to an end. The album cover nightclub is becoming more and more populated by the day. The VIP section is popping off. We hope you've enjoyed the podcast. Please give us a like and comment any questions you may have. Subscribe and, most importantly, follow us on the socials at Death With The Record. Instagram, particularly this week, is going to have some
quality content.
Yeah, some quality content. All the Sean Ryder memes you could possibly imagine. So, yeah, get on that and we'll see you next week.